Why did the tunnel formerly used to transport deadly nuclear waste at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State suddenly collapse on Tuesday, May 9th? Was there a deadly release of radiation that was concealed from the public? How responsible is the Department of Energy and its contractors in protecting the public from known hazards associated with this site? Is the situation under control as authorities are leading us to believe? How much worse could the situation have been? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we probe the possible release of radiative material to the environment from one of the most radioactive sites on Earth, and what is and is not being done to mitigate the threat. We'll get perspectives from Tom Carpenter, director of a Washington State-based watchdog group, activist Mimi Gurman, and investigative journalist Susanna Frame. On this week's program, Radiological Threat to the West Coast. Is the truth about the Hanford Tunnel collapse being concealed from the public? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 12th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and Campus Community Radio Station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Now, a little-known video made by the leader of Tahrir al-Sham, or al-Qaeda, in Syria, Abu Jaber, on March 16, 2017, is making the rounds of social media, showing Jaber praising the white helmets as the, quote, hidden soldiers of the revolution, unquote, and thanking them for what they do. Here's the quote. Second, a message of thanks and gratitude to the hidden soldiers of our revolution, Jaber said. On top of the list are the parents of the martyrs and the men of the white helmets, unquote. The question then becomes, if the white helmets are so unbiased, why does Tahrir al-Sham consider them to be heroes of the revolution? That comes from the article, Al-Qaeda Leader Praises Syria White Helmets as Hidden Soldiers of the Revolution, by Brandon Turbeville, posted May 9th, originally appearing at Activist Post. U.S. President Donald Trump has authorized the arming of Kurdish forces in Syria despite fierce opposition from Turkey. The Pentagon made the announcement on Tuesday, stressing that arming the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, is to ensure a clear victory in operations aimed at the liberation of Raqqa from the Daesh terrorist group. The U.S. currently provides air support for members of the SDF, a Kurdish-dominated and anti-Damascus alliance. They have largely surrounded Raqqa and are expected to begin an offensive soon. The SDF is led by the Kurdish People's Protection Units, or YPG, which Ankara views as a terrorist organization over its alleged links to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. That comes from the article, Washington approves arming Kurdish forces in Syria against Turkey, its NATO ally, posted May 9th, originally appearing at Press TV. The U.S. and Jordanian militaries may be prepping a massive invasion of Syria, intelligence reports gathered from surveillance drones suggest. Damascus is reportedly on high alert after some 400 American and Jordanian military vehicles were located at a Jordanian military base near the Syrian desert border earlier today. The foreign convoys may launch an incursion to aid allied Free Syrian Army, or FSA, proxies based around the Al-Tanf border crossing. In 2017 alone, FSA satellite forces have entered Swida and Deir Ezzor, while also coming dangerously near Palmyra and Damascus, areas under Syrian Arab Army control. In response to the looming invasion, the SAA has begun a large-scale offensive along the Damascus-Baghdad highway in a bid to dislodge FSA rebels from the Al-Tanf border crossing or link up with friendly Iraqi border guards. That comes from the article, Is the U.S. Preparing a Ground Invasion of Syria? Drones Spot Hundreds of U.S. Jordanian Armored Vehicles at Border, by Chris Thompson, posted May 9th, originally appearing at Al-Mazdar News. Earlier, Russia, Turkey, and Iran signed a memorandum on the establishment of security zones in Syria. According to the memorandum, checkpoints and observation centers will be established along the borders of these security zones. The zones exclude aircraft from hostile action. When answering the question whether the coalition will stop the flights over these security zones, the Pentagon official said that the coalition will carry on with its operations as usual with no regard for Russia's plans to end airstrikes in the region. And here's a quote. The coalition will continue to strike ISIS wherever they operate to make sure they have no safe retreat, the official stated, answering the question whether the U.S. was prepared to cease the flights over these security zones in Syria. That comes from the article, U.S. says we fly where we want in Syria, posted May 9th, originally appearing at EN Newsfront. The agents of stability want to rebuild Syria and strengthen it as part of a wider Shia bloc. In practice, their policy would achieve, even if it does not directly aim for, a regional balance of forces, similar to the standoff between the U.S. and Russia in the Cold War. It is not ideal, but it is far preferable to the alternative policy pursued by the agents of anarchy. They want key states in the Middle East to implode, as has already happened in Iraq and Libya, and has been partially achieved in Syria. We know the consequences of this policy. Massive sectarian blood spilling, huge internal population displacement, and the creation of waves of refugees who head towards the relative stability of Europe, the seizure and dispersal of military arsenals that spur yet more fighting, and the inspiration of more militant and reactionary ideologies like that of ISIS. That comes from the article, Syria and the Project to Balkanize the Middle East, by Jonathan Cook, posted May 9th, originally appearing at the Jonathan Cook blog. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On the morning of Tuesday, May 9th, the U.S. Department of Energy activated their Emergency Operations Center at the Hanford site, a 20-foot section of a tunnel at the site containing highly toxic and radioactive material had collapsed, exposing the contents to the atmosphere. According to officials, the collapse was discovered during routine surveillance Tuesday morning. Workers in the affected area north of the Y barricade were told to take cover, that is, go indoors and shut off ventilation systems. Later in the day, non-essential workers north of the Y barricade were told to go home early. Officials claim that beginning the morning of Wednesday, May 10th, crews began work filling the hole. 550 cubic yards of soil in 53 trucks were used. The emergency was terminated later that evening at 11:21 p.m. Workers have since begun to return to work. Can we trust the officials when they say there was no radiological contamination to the surrounding area? Are the workers safe? Could more collapses be looming? On Wednesday, May 10th, the Global Research News Hour started investigating the incident. We first located a watchdog and worker advocacy group, which has been working to correct existing hazards associated with the Hanford site for decades. I'm joined right now by Tom Carpenter. He is the executive director of Hanford Challenge. So thank you very much for joining us, Tom Carpenter. Just maybe to start off, could you give us a bit of background about your group?
Okay, yeah. Hanford Challenge is an organization. You know, we're based in Seattle, Washington, but we do oversee Hanford nuclear site, which is a former plutonium production site in southeastern Washington. And it's on the Columbia River, it's about 150 miles south of Spokane, if that gives anybody, a way to place it. But this is the most contaminated site in the United States and really the hemisphere. Two-thirds of our plutonium waste, high-level waste is stored there. And there are a lot of problems left to deal with. The site is no longer in production. It's not making plutonium anymore. It was shut down really in 1989 and transitioned to a cleanup mode. But that doesn't mean that the site is safe or that the environment is protected or that, you know, workers are protected. And as this latest thing indicates, so our mission at Hanford Challenge is a safe and effective cleanup of the Hanford site. And we help accomplish that mission by protecting nuclear whistleblowers. We're attorneys here. We also monitor the site. We get involved in oversight boards. We write reports. We testify in Congress and all the things you would expect as an outside entity, not connected with officially with Hanford in any way, but to go in and observe the situation and report upon it.
Okay. Now, and of course, at least what I'm hearing from press reports and people on the ground is that you've been in touch with a lot of the workers who were present at the time. And we were heard when this incident happened. It was Tuesday, May the 9th in the morning when this tunnel collapsed, or rather the ceiling of this tunnel collapsed. And it was a section. Approximately how long is that tunnel?
It's a few hundred feet long. I don't know exactly how long, but it's hundreds of feet.
Okay.
I know in Canada you say meters, but here we say feet. But it's quite a long tunnel, and it's one of two major tunnels out there.
Okay. And have there been concerns about the integrity of this collapse, or did this come as just a complete surprise? Nobody could have foreseen this.
No, unfortunately, there was a review 2 years ago from an agency called the Consortium of Risk Evaluation and Stakeholder Participation. So that group was commissioned by Congress to take a look at some of the high-risk areas at the Hanford site and other sites, but Hanford was a big focus. And they identified 2 years ago that these tunnels were subject to failure, that the roof could collapse. And after all, tunnel number one, which was in service from the 1950s through the, 1965, is only shored up by Douglas fir timbers. Now, we in the Northwest love our Douglas fir, but they're not necessarily the best, support for an underground tunnel holding nuclear waste. The waste in this tunnel is pretty bad off. So, yes, we've had warnings about this. There were some other earlier assessments done by some other agencies that have raised, the issue of this is a higher priority than you might think. This tunnel could collapse. It could be a small earthquake or something that would cause that. And, we did have a heavy rain year, even in the Tri-Cities. There was snow. And there was road work going on nearby, which could have led to shaking that caused the tunnel collapse. But we don't know yet what.
Yeah. Okay. So this, but it did collapse, and they said that's when they said that workers were evacuated and were told to take cover, which I mean, get outside, get away from the outside air. You've spoken to some of the people who were present at the time. What have they been telling you about what happened?
Well, I got an alert, a text, really, almost as soon as it happened. And someone wrote, PRX tunnels collapsed. I'd just gotten into work, and it was like, wow, that's big. So we started immediately trying to find out information. And, it was starting to spread. People were talking about it. And this was about 8:30 in the morning on Tuesday morning. And the from what was described to me is they were sending, firefighters out. Anytime there's an emergency at Hanford, they've got an on-site fire department. So we were told that, the fire trucks were closer than 150 feet from the mouth of the tunnel because of radiation dose. And other were reporting high radiation doses. There are a lot of very radioactive items inside this tunnel, including railway cars that were used to transport spent nuclear fuel in the past. And those cars were all filled with radioactive materials. I understand from looking at some of the inventories that there was a lot of cesium-137 in these tunnels. That's a radioactive element that puts out high gamma radiation, which is a penetrating form of radiation. So it's understandable that there would be high radiation levels if you have a hole in the tunnel. The initial response of the site, to reporters at least, was, there's a depression in the ground. There's not a hole. That turned out to be incorrect. They also told some reporters that there was no radioactive waste. And, that tune quickly changed as it emerged of a hole that was actually pretty big. It looked like the size of a truck. And then that continued to get bigger during the course of the day. So now there's an estimated, 20 feet of that tunnel up, a hole about 400 square feet of exposed tunnel. And the concern was and has been that loose contamination could come out of that tunnel into the atmosphere. That's subject to being inhaled by people, by workers, or carried off site by winds and contaminate, a section of soil or whatever. And the river is about 6 miles away from there. So that's the major concern. But that turns out apparently not to have been one of the things that happened. So fortunately, it's not been a radiation cloud release. But they took, precautionary steps. They declared a site emergency, ordered all workers to take cover and to not access outside air, right, to go inside and shut off the vents. That means turning off air conditioners and any other windows that might be open, and wait. And that's the standard condition for a nuclear accident, is not to let in any outside particles. And so eventually people were evacuated. And I think there were 5,000 people that had to take cover as a result of this. And they tried to get their arms around how bad is this, what do you do about it, et cetera. And so today, the day after the tunnel collapse, the hole is still there, but they are starting to fill it in with soil and sand. Workers are still not allowed on the site, at least not close to the action over there. Mm-hmm. We'll get that taken care of and that filled in so that the station is not coming out of that hole anymore. And then they have to figure out what to do to remediate this problem.
Yeah. I just wanted to read a statement. This is from Destry Henderson, who's the deputy news manager for the Hanford Joint Information Center. And he told the NBC News is that I would underscore this, saying this yesterday, I would underscore this is confined to a small area of the Hanford site. The facility does have radiological contamination right now, but there is no indication of a radiological release. So that's that stands as far as you are aware?
No, I think that's probably true. I think there are some indications of localized, around the hole release. And there certainly is, again, gamma radiation coming out of that hole, which Hanford has kind of used some clever words to avoid speaking about that. Because the levels of radiation of the material in the hole are so high that you would, over the course of maybe an hour or two, get a lethal dose of radiation. That material has to be remotely handled. It's so hot, right? You have to send a robot in, or a crane or something like that to because humans can't get too close to that kind of radiation field. So they're a bit, you know, spinning it downwards a little bit and trying to assure people this is a 585-square mile site. So saying it's a small part of the site is ridiculous, right? I mean, that's, compared to 585 square miles, this is small, but that's not the point. The point is that they had a collapse of a tunnel containing high levels of radiological materials. And the fact that they, you know, were lucky that there wasn't high winds when this happened, they should not take credit for. That's nothing to brag about, right? It could have been different circumstances. And we're still not done, right? There's still materials inside that tunnel that could be, explosive or catch on fire. There's chemicals in there, et cetera. So we're not out of the woods yet. And he certainly wasn't out of the woods when he made that statement. So I guess I would take issue. I mean, yes, people do not need to panic. There's no reason to get in your cars and drive away. There's no big release happening. And we're not over it yet. So, Hanford does tend to engage in minimizing the news and not being forthright. And on the other hand, I'm not aware of any worker that has been exposed, which is very good news. Nor am I aware of any big radiological release.
Okay. As you mentioned, there's soil and sand that's being dumped on the site. Would you say, as far as anyone can tell, the threat of a major wind suddenly picking up and dispersing extremely radioactive material abroad is a lessened concern at this point?
It's getting there. Okay. I'm not sure how far they are along in filling the trench. I know they've started to do that. And to the extent that they're able to accomplish that today would be very good news. I think the site does deserve credit for getting workers out of the way of this, for the appropriate responses of putting worker protection first and, also in their transparency. I mean, they set up a Facebook Live page. They've given press briefings. And so I will give the site management a lot of credit for all of that. I think they're mitigating the problem quickly. Are we done? No. Could there be more collapse happen in that trench? Yeah, 20 feet has collapsed, but does that mean more will collapse? We don't know. Hanford certainly does not know. So I guess the question now is, what can be done to mitigate future collapse of the same tunnel or the adjoining tunnel? And what are some of the other areas at Hanford that are in the same decrepit condition, subject to sudden collapse, that could present even more of a risk than the Purex tunnels? So that's our major concern right now is whether or not management out there, the federal government, is really acting quickly enough to get on top of these risks and to act in a timely manner to prevent things like tunnel collapses. Because, as much as the news can be, made to be good that nobody was hurt, it was bad that this tunnel collapsed. You don't do that, right? That should never have happened. And you want to prevent that from happening at other facilities at the Hanford site. And there are other facilities out there that are of great concern.
What do you think, in your estimation, because, I mean, this isn't the only issue for certain, but with the Hanford site generally, what are the obstacles that you seem to be running into when you when you advocate for changes or more prudent actions to protect the environment and the public? Is it money or are there other issues involved that seem to be you seem to be running against?
It's a complicated answer, but it comes down to the federal government, ran the Hanford site from the 1940s. up and through the production era up until 1989 with fairly callous disregard for worker health and safety and for the safety of people in the area. So they've had several major radiological releases, some of them deliberate. Back in 1957, they had the Green Run accident. That's not an accident, the Green Run release, where they deliberately released a bunch of iodine 131 to track the cloud of that to see if they could figure out where Russian facilities were located. Famous documented accident, lots of radiation released on purpose. They've got a very sordid and long history of conducting their operations in a very sloppy manner that emphasized the production of plutonium at the expense of the public, of the workers, and of the environment. So that's when that mission ended at Hanford to make plutonium, the government stuck with this same agency that had habits of secrecy, of retaliation against workers who raised concerns and raised safety issues, did a poor job of accounting for where the money went. And surprise, surprise, 30 years later, that same agency is still acting in the same way. The Department of Energy and the contractors at the Hanford site are very secretive. They're not transparent. You can't trust what they say. They retaliate against the employees who raise safety concerns over and over and over again to the point where Congress, you know, and investigative agencies are documenting this. Laws are being passed to deal with it, but Hanford doesn't change. You know, their workers are still getting exposed to, you know, chemical vapors. Hanford refuses to acknowledge that there are health effects that result from these exposures. So that has led to us in the state of Washington and a union to file a lawsuit to compel Hanford to protect these workers. And that's worked to a degree. But why are we filing lawsuits to make them protect their own workers? So this is a long, a complicated answer to your question. Is the wrong people are running the cleanup at the Hanford site is really what it comes down to. This is not a government agency that either is institutionally capable of running this cleanup in a way that it needs to be run, but they don't have the confidence to do so as well. And I'll just finally say that Hanford has turned into somewhat of a fraud factory. There's a lot of fraud that happens out there. Four contractors in the last several years have had to pay money to the federal government after being caught defrauding the government. One company pled guilty to felonies and paid $18.5 million in fines. You know, managers were indicted. That company still works at the Hanford site. They're still making money out there. Even after all that, other companies pled guilty or don't admit liability, and yet two of them just paid $125 million to the U.S. government for alleged fraud against them, brought forward by whistleblowers. So their money is probably not being that well spent, and that's also been documented. So you've got big, big problems with the cleanup out there, with the priorities, with the management of the site. And the public is the one likely to take the brunt of a serious accident in the future because of this broken system.
Tom Carpenter, I really want to thank you for sharing these insights on this important news story on what's been happening out there. And hopefully we can get some more updates in the not-too-distant future. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We've been speaking with Tom Carpenter, the executive director of Seattle-based Hanford Challenge. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Mimi Gurman is a self-identified Earth activist, the founder of Radcast.org, a citizen body which has been documenting radiation measurements across the United States, and is also active with the anti-nuclear advocacy group No Nukes Northwest. She's been monitoring the situation at the Hanford site. I contacted her and asked if she felt at all comforted by the Department of Energy's May 10th announcement that the emergency they activated the morning of Tuesday, May 9th, around the Hanford site had been lifted.
I haven't been comforted by any of the information coming out. My first reason for that is that we don't know the measurements of radiation that have come out of that tunnel since this happened a few days ago. Without knowing measurements, this is the same thing that happened at Fukushima. The same thing that happened at Three Mile Island, the same thing that happened at Chernobyl. When we don't know the measurements, we don't have any true data to go off of to determine just how bad this is. What we do know is that this tunnel, like I said a few seconds ago, was shuttered decades ago because it was releasing or containing, it was really a release of 5 Rankins an hour of radiation. A Rankin is equal to 1 rad. A worker at Hanford is only allowed to have 5 Rankins per year. So this tunnel per hour was creating more radiation than in 1 hour than a person was allowed to have in 1 year. So that's what was inside the tunnel years ago. Now we have a collapsed hole over that very same tunnel containing the very same thing that was creating the 5 Rankins per hour at that time. So we know that there was a radiation release, and we know that the radiation release was big. We just don't know what big means. Now, I don't think that big means the numbers that we were seeing at a triple meltdown in Fukushima. However, any amount of radiation can cause cancer. So back to how much damage was actually inflicted upon the workers. We don't know because we don't have those measurements. I have a Geiger counter. Friends of mine have Geiger counters. We live in Portland. We could go to Hanford to, you know, see how things are, but it's a dangerous place right now. I won't go right now. I won't submit myself to the levels of radiation that I believe are there. The levels of radiation that I do believe are there are high because we are seeing on the EPA RadNet monitoring site in Richland, which is where Hanford is, an uptick of radiation. The normal ambient background for that particular monitoring station is anywhere between 190 and, let's say, 210 counts per minute. Now, again, this is a large monitor. We're not talking about a Geiger counter, which that would be high for a Geiger counter. But for the monitor, it's relatively, you know, stable at Hanford. Now, the uptick immediately went to around 300. So from a background norm of around 200 to a new background norm right now of 300, and today it's at 350. So it's getting hotter. We also saw that west of Hanford, or Richland, where this monitoring station is, there's another monitor in Yakima or Ellensburg, and that monitor also went up to 300. So these are coinciding readings at two different monitors on a level or a parallel line. So there's radiation that's coming out of that hole. Now, I know that they took in whatever it was, 53 truckloads of dirt to cover up the radiation. And if that's in fact what they did, I haven't seen photos of it. And again, I don't take their word for anything that they say they do until we can actually prove that photographs are true and not created to promote PR, which happens at Hanford. So I don't know that the dirt has been put on there. I'm assuming the dirt was dumped into this hole to cover up the radiation and keep it contained. We're still seeing an uptick of radiation on the RadNet monitor. Where's it coming from? If they've covered the hole up, why are we seeing today the uptick again from 300 to 350 counts per minute? I don't know. What I do know is that's radiation. And so we're left with a lot of questions, and until these questions are answered, we really can't accept anything that the DOE puts out or that Hanford puts out, because their PR machine, of the $2 billion that Hanford gets every year from the government, part of that money goes to their PR machine. They're allowed to use that money. It's for cleanup at Hanford, and part of cleanup at Hanford means clean up the PR. So the PR goes out, and they have a lot of money and a lot of force behind their PR. Look at most people right now and what they're believing. They're believing that this has been cleaned up. They're believing that no radiation has escaped. They're believing that even though there's been an article that has said from Bob Alvarez that there were, at the time of the closure of the tunnel, 5 Rankines per hour that were going out, somehow, miraculously, no radiation has gone out, thanks to the PR machine at Hanford. So that's where we are now, Michael, with questions. How many workers are going to get cancer from this? Where were the workers in their protective gear on those trucks putting that dirt in? I didn't see any. Mm. When they had an image yesterday of a tractor out there, you know, doing something around there, there was no protective clothing on those people.
I noticed that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So either that was a fake photo, this is what we were talking about, or they're doing their, you know, radioactive genocide again, which is what they did in Fukushima.
Mimi Gurman is referring here to where TEPCO authorities in Japan started recruiting homeless and other people to work at the Fukushima site, a dynamic reference during this program's 6th anniversary coverage of the Fukushima disaster. I asked Mimi further about monitoring of the radiation releases from the Hanford event. She claimed more monitors were brought in.
They had to bring in monitors around the area because it was so radiated. They don't tell you that. They just say, we brought in monitors, you know, as if this is a normal occurrence. It's not a normal occurrence. First of all, the monitors should have been there. If the monitors weren't there, why did they have to bring them there? The answer is because it was so radiated, they needed to track where that radiation was. So all of these things point to the fact that their statement of there was no radiation release is false. Mm-hmm. Every single thing they've said, there's a different way to look at it to show that it's a false statement.
I had spoken earlier to Tom Carpenter of the Hanford Challenge, and he talked about mm-hmm. how the DOE and the people it contracts with at the site have a history of secrecy, of lack of transparency. You can't trust what they say, and they tend to retaliate against employees that speak out. That's almost an exact quote. And so I'm wondering if these same entities are responsible for addressing the remediation, the repairs, you know, what do you have any immediate questions about how they're going about it, in spite of the fact that, well, if this tunnel, this 20-foot section of the tunnel has collapsed, could it not happen again? Like, what caused it in the first place? And so what are the things we should be demanding of these entities?
Okay, so the first demand is, what were the measurements? What were the radiological measurements? That's first. The second is, what are you doing specifically? What are you doing to ensure that nothing else from this tunnel gets out, that there are no more collapses? Already, you know, we know from, you know, just basic engineering that if you have a site that has been damaged like this has, the structure's been damaged, what else is going to happen to that structure? It's been compromised. And everything in that tunnel is highly radioactive. This isn't like, you know, gloves that your X-ray technician had to put into a special case. This is stuff from plutonium and uranium directly. So, yeah, what are they doing? What exactly? What is the plan? What have you been doing? And I don't want the answer is not we put 53 dump trucks of dirt in there. That's not an answer. You know, mm-hmm. And, you know, what have the engineers said? How did they determine whatever it is that they've said that we don't know what they've said? You know, how did they make these determinations? Okay. How do we know what you're saying even has a plan? And more than likely the same. So let me explain. On Hanford's property, the idea recently, the last decade, was to create a vitrification plant and take the waste from 177 leaking tanks, a million gallon tanks of highly radioactive goo, and move that into the vitrification plant to make glass logs, which then would be put into, at the time, it was supposed to go to Yucca Mountain. So that didn't happen because Yucca's not safe. And even though they'd be put into glass form, those would also decay. But that was the plan. The actual plans for the vitrification plant, the plans, you know, that when you look at a plan to say this is how it's going to be built, the plans themselves were faulty. So the building had to stop because the plans, like somebody didn't check the plan to say, from an engineering perspective, will this building even hold up? And the answer was no. So they had to stop everything because the plans weren't good. And we're talking just hundreds of millions and billions of dollars going into building this vitrification plant, because it wasn't just the glass logs. It was a pretreatment plant. So the waste had to go from the tanks to the pretreatment, from the pretreatment to, you know, another end of it to into the vitrification plant. These people specifically, these contractors, are Bechtel and CH2M Hill. They are so corrupt. They are the most corrupt contractors, or one of the top most corrupt contractors in the United States and in the world. And these are the people who are in charge of Hanford. These are the people who get that $2 billion a year to disperse, to quote unquote remediate Hanford. Tom Carpenter, I know Tom, we've talked quite a few times over the last couple days. We all know this. We all know how they work, and they lie. And they lie to make more money. And this is not hyperbole. This is not an exaggeration. This is the reality at Hanford. We know that you can't clean up the way, at least, these contractors claim that they are cleaning up. It's even the word cleanup is an irony, because they're not cleaning up, even if they could clean it up. Okay. So now, the way that I look at this whole thing since the collapse happened and the PR that's going out is, this is a cover-up of the covering up of the collapsed hole. And until we get information on how did they know how hot the tunnel is right now, in order to be assured that the radiation pinging against the timber and against the concrete, which is eroding it, that's what radiation does. How do we know that they had this opportunity to get in the tunnel? How do we know that they know how hot it is today? And that they took that into consideration for how the remediation, or the 53 dump trucks of dirt, was going to not only cover the radiation leak in that spot, but also control future damage to that tunnel. And there is no way that they could have figured this out in 2 days. I guarantee you that. So the probability is something will happen. Something always happens at Hanford, but I'm speaking specifically about this tunnel. We will see people get sick from this.
We've been speaking with Mimi Gurman, Earth activist, founder of radcast.org, and active with No Nukes Northwest. She spoke to us from Portland. Susanna Frame is the chief investigative reporter for King 5 News, an NBC affiliate in Seattle. Her reporting has earned her multiple awards, including the Emmy, Peabody, Clarion, and Edgar R. Murrow Awards. She's been reporting on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation for years and broke the story of Tuesday's Purax tunnel collapse. She joins us now from Seattle. Susanna, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us.
You bet. My pleasure. I just got back from the Hanford area, back in Seattle, and I'm happy to be on your program.
Okay, so we're speaking now. It's Thursday, May the 11th. It is about 4:30 your time, Pacific time. Can you update us on the situation? What's the latest on what's happening with the site?
Well, as you mentioned, they have stood down on their emergency status. And let me make something clear. This is a nuclear site. It's a dangerous place. It's the most contaminated work site in America or the Western Hemisphere. But they do not activate these site-wide emergencies very often. So I just wanted to put that out there, that this was a highly unusual event. They had not activated that emergency center, that site-wide status of emergency, for 4 years. So unusual, all of the workers feel the same way. The emergency status has been terminated, as you reported, but that doesn't mean everything's, you know, hunky-dory. They have managed to repair the collapsed tunnel, which made a gaping hole in the earth in the center of this massive reservation. And that's the good news. But that tunnel collapsed when that was never, of course, Plan A. And this particular tunnel is 360-something feet long. So if there's a collapse there, what's to say there isn't going to be a collapse 50 feet away? I mean, obviously, the structure was undermined. Obviously, conditions are such that this is something that, it can happen again. And the state of Washington has taken legal action to demand to know what happened and what are you going to do about it. And so I would say, you know, you will hear from the officials, rosy, you know, statements like everything's fine. But, you know, the real story is there's still a danger there, and they're still not allowing people near that area. So people did go back to work today after a day and a half off, but they're steering clear of that tunnel area.
Do we have a better idea now of exactly what triggered this collapse?
Well, from the very beginning, my sources thought they knew what triggered it. But it sounds to me like it's basically the straw that broke the camel's back, right? There was road work going on very near the site. And so my sources, who are veteran employees with years of experience, they are opining that it was the vibration from some of the heavy equipment doing road work in that area that caused it. But, you know, I don't think anything. I mean, I'm certainly not an engineer, but I can't imagine that you have a structure in place since the 1960s and then one day of road work is going to cause it to fail. And so there's been a degradation, obviously, of that structure over the years. And by the way, the story that I aired last night and is on our website right now is that this should not have been a surprise. Hanford managers, these are the people in charge there, are federal employees. The U.S. Department of Energy owns and operates Hanford. They have been warned from advocacy groups and experts since the mid-90s that something like this could happen. And that was my story last night, that as we see a pattern at Hanford, as we've seen in many other instances, there is a pattern of denial and delay, and it typically comes back to money. Advocacy groups, like I said, since the mid-90s and up until just last year, were saying, hey, get money from Congress so that we can characterize exactly what you have stuffed down in those sealed-up tunnels, characterize it, and let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of it safely, because that tunnel could collapse and expose people, especially the workforce, to potentially get contaminated with radioactive particles. And instead of saying, you're right, let's at least do a study, what they said just in 2015 was, hey, we hired some consultants that said we're good for 30 more years. So in my story last night, I said that would have put us in 2045 that we might see a problem, not 2017.
I feel, I need to point out, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this like an earthquake zone? If machinery, heavy machinery could somehow trigger a collapse, what would tremors do? Thinking like a domino effect or something like that. Isn't that not also a significant consideration?
Yes, absolutely. It always has been. The state of Washington is divided down, not really the middle, but divided by the Cascade Mountain Range. Western Washington, where we live in Seattle, much higher likelihood of a really big earthquake. We're where the fault line is. But there have been tremors, small earthquakes in eastern Washington, and you are right. That is definitely a concern. Time is of the essence. But, tick-tock, the cleanup has been going on since 1988, 89, and there's so much work left to be done. And while this is happening, things aren't getting any newer. They're not getting any shinier. The infrastructure is falling apart. And this is a wake-up call, should have been a wake-up call, that you've got buildings that are compromised, you've got tunnels, you've got nuclear waste tanks that are leaking. That's been my expertise, is the nuclear waste tanks, which is in a different part of this huge 565-mile-wide reservation. This cleanup has gone on so much longer than anyone ever thought, and has cost so much more money than anyone ever thought. And as time goes on, just like I said, if you can't keep up with the funding and make sure people are safe, it's just a recipe for bad stuff to happen, and that's what we saw 2 days ago.
I just came across what seemed to be some contradictory accounts. In the King 5 story that I read that came out on Tuesday, there was Destry Henderson, deputy news manager for the Hanford Joint Information Center, quoted as saying, "The facility does have radiological contamination right now, but there's no indication of a radiological release." But in the statement that came out last night from the U.S. DOE Richland Operations Office, which terminated the emergency, I'm reading this, "No radiological contamination was detected as a result of the collapse or while the hole was being filled." So, and also I should point out, when I was speaking to Mimi Gurman not too long ago, she said that there were radiation detectors, the EPA RadNet monitors in Richland and Yakama, which registered since the collapse an increase, like a significant increase, a spike in radiation. So I'm wondering, these seem like contradictory indicators. I'm wondering if there's anything you could say that might shed some light into all of this.
Yeah, I can. I am, again, not a radiation expert, but I've had very long conversations with people who are. And this is my understanding. Sources of mine, immediately, a couple hours into it, were telling me that monitors, basically like a Geiger counter, right, around the hole, were showing increased radiation readings. Now, you can hold a Geiger counter near me right now, and I'm, way away in Seattle. It wouldn't be that unusual, right, to just have some sort of radiation, like an X-ray or something, but, to be monitored and to show up on a monitoring device. So, what they're saying to my experts that I talk to are telling me that yes, there were elevated levels of radiation detected near the area at the time, but that is different from contamination. And that sounds really weird, and it's hard for me to get my brain wrapped around, but I'll just try to quickly explain it. I think what they're saying is that the items themselves, there are rail cars under there. That's what was stuffed in that tunnel and sealed up for decades. It's emanating like heat, like radiation, and then it dissipates. What they're saying is that particles of radioactive material did not get disturbed and go up into the air and land somewhere. So you didn't have radioactive particles coming out and landing on people or landing on the environment that would be what they would call then contamination. The elevated readings of radiation. Do you want to stand right there at that time? Absolutely not. And that's why people aren't in there. And trust me, I am not a Hanford apologist. I mean, I beat up on them all the time for their failures, for their lack of transparency, for their dumb decisions, for putting money above human safety. But this is my understanding, and I have not seen evidence to the contrary at this point. I probably would be the first reporter to get it, I would assume, because of my network of sources, if that does come to fruition, that we do get documentation and proof of contamination. But that is different from an elevated reading of radiation. And I think that's what you're referencing.
Okay. Well, thanks for that clarification. I'll just ask one more question and then I'll let you go. I'm wondering about my understanding is that the winds were not as high that day on Tuesday, so things were not as bad as they could have been. But I'm wondering if you could perhaps give our listeners an understanding of the worst case scenario, either be it on Tuesday or even moving forward. What are the stakes if the repair crew and the authorities don't get it right for the workers and for the surrounding population and perhaps even beyond?
Well, let me tell you, that's a windy, windy place. I grew up in eastern Washington, and it can be so windy. When I was over there all day long on Tuesday and Wednesday and part of today, and it was completely stagnant. The air was not moving at all. That is the luckiest break that those people got over there. If a 20, 30-mile-per-hour wind came through there, a gust came through with that open pit, the air would act as like a suction cup. It could have. The wind could have. That, like, create a vortex and then bring up the particles and scatter them around. Then you've got contamination. So they were in quite a hurry to get that thing sealed up. You know, worst-case scenario there is that there's another collapse, and it is windy, or there's a collapse and items, the rail cars, crumble and fall on each other and create enough energy, right, to get the particles up. The good news is that it's not liquid waste. That's the most dangerous stuff out there, is the 56 million gallons of liquid waste, because the liquid emanates vapors, chemically contaminated vapors. And you're not going to get vapors from these, you know, solid items, but you know you do have the possibility of whipping up particles of contamination that, again, windy could spread for miles and miles away. And I guess the worst case situation would be if a fire were to start down there. Then you could see things start to explode, and that same goes for the tank farms. Worst situation there is that you have a hydrogen pressure buildup and an explosion, and then you've got, you know, I don't want to scare people, but then you've got radiation going, having the potential to have so much force, right, from an explosion or fire, that you've got radioactive material spreading over at least a three-state area.
Okay. Well,
that's the worst-case scenario, and it's not good.
We've been speaking with King Five's Susanna Frame, the investigative reporter who broke the Hanford Purex tunnel collapse story. You can stay up to speed on the situation by following her Twitter feed. Her handle is at SFRAMEK5. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.